There is no tiptoeing into the unknown. Welcome to the future of medicine, where disease is no match for tenacity, no match for ingenuity, where together we go boldly. Learn more at goboldly.com.
Good Friday afternoon, I'm Jake Sherman, and welcome to a special bonus episode of the Playbook Audio Briefing. Today we're bringing you the first of three bonus episodes from our live podcast taping that we recorded at 6th and I Synagogue Thursday night. Up first is our panel with Politico All-Stars Rachel Bade, Sungmin Kim, and Annie Carney. We talked about covering Congress, the White House, Jared and Ivanka, Donald Trump, and the climate in Washington today. Tomorrow we'll post our conversation with the New York Times' Michael Barbaro, host of the hit podcast The Daily, and our discussion with DCCC Executive Director Dan Cena and NRCC Executive Director John Rogers. Be sure to subscribe and review our podcast on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever you listen, and watch Playbook for a link tomorrow.
But without further ado, let us introduce our all-star Politico reporter panel. If you guys want to come on up. We have Annie Carney, who's coming up. She covers the White House for Politico. Rachel Bade, who covers House Republicans. And Sungmin Kim, who covers the Senate and all things judiciary for us.
Give them a round of applause. All right, guys, the trick is you have to talk, like, really into the mic. So just
get comfortable. Bring it,
get comfortable.
So, Rachel, we have to start with you because you came here. This is a very busy night, and she's taking some time off from the latest sexual harassment scandal that has been enveloping right now. You broke some news, literally, like, I think as we arrived here, the story was coming out.
Well, let's talk about how the story came to be, Rachel.
And well, I love the laugh.
No, actually, let's actually not talk about that.
Okay, I was going to say, do you really want to talk about that? Okay. So Trent Franks, the latest member of Congress to announce today that he's going to be resigning at the end of January of 2018.
So Arizona Republican, very conservative.
Family values, et cetera, et cetera. But we found out that he had talked to some staffers about potentially being a surrogate for him and his wife.
Well, let's be careful here. He talked about surrogacy with his staffers.
Right.
Whether he asked them to be a surrogate, I guess we don't know.
So we heard. But the statement confirmed that he spoke to them about surrogacy, right? So apparently these folks felt uncomfortable. They went to the ethics committee, the ethics committee found out about it somehow, and they launched an investigation. Trent Franks found out about it apparently today or yesterday and decided that he is going to step down instead of try to fight this. He is the first Republican to announce his resignation. This comes on the heels of, obviously, John Conyers earlier this week and Al Franken. So heads are rolling, and they probably will continue to.
Talk to us. How does this happen? I mean, this was within a matter of 60 minutes almost from when we started hearing rumblings of this. We were all in the Capitol to actually confirming and, you know, getting the story out there.
So my sense on this is, and there was another announcement just tonight, which is that there's an investigation of Blake Fahrenholt. As we had reported last week, he had a settlement for sexual harassment with a former staffer in his office, and she came out and spoke to Politico about how she was blackballed after she alleged that he had sexually harassed her and hasn't been able to find a job.
She was basically babysitting, right? I mean, she went from being a staff assistant on the Hill to the only job.
Not being able to find a job, three years trying to find a job and still unable to, babysitting on the side, trying to make ends meet. But basically the ethics committee, they put out a series of statements, and my sense on this is that they had to probably notify Trent Franks that this was, you know, going to be put out there, and that pushed things along.
Let's take a pause here for a second, and we'll get to Annie and the White House in a second, but this is such a late-breaking story. So, Sungmin, you and I have worked together for a long time, in the Capitol for a long time. Like, how bad is this going to get? what do you think?
I think it's fair to say, and I know you guys have said this as well, that there are a lot of news organizations who are hearing a lot of things and devoting a lot of resources into investigating these allegations, obviously doing our due diligence to make sure all these accusations check out, and a lot of them don't. We've gotten some tips that clearly don't seem to have much merit and kind of have, you know, gone off that. But I think that there does seem to be this sense on Capitol Hill, like, who is next? And I think the first allegations against Senator Franken just really came out of nowhere. I remember I was walking to actually the Judiciary Committee hearing where Senator Franken is a member of, because I just had to grab some quotes for the day story, whether it was on taxes or shutdown or whatever it was.
It all blends together.
It really does at this point. And I was chasing a senator up to his office asking some questions about tax reform. And then I look on my phone and I see the story, the firsthand account from Leanne Tweeden. And I think just how quickly this moves has been really surprising. How quickly it moved, particularly yesterday after we reported on the latest allegations. I think there was a sense in the Capitol that with Senator Franken, and some of the female senators had been talking for a while about how bothered they were by these accusations, and yet it was finally just our story that kind of broke the dam on this. And we knew that a lot of times when these accusations come, there are usually a lot more that come out, which obviously happened with the senator, but it was never really going to be clear until it happened which one would kind of just bring the flood of resignation calls like we saw yesterday.
Anna and I always talk about, and it's stunning, whether it's like spending issues or whatever, Capitol Hill polices itself, as many of you know, because I'm sure many of you have either interned in the Capitol or worked in the Capitol or interacted with members of Congress. They set their own HR rules. They police themselves. They, as Anna,
they are not subjected to FOIA.
They're not subject to open records laws. Anna likes to remind me all the time, it's like they're on the honor system, right? It's like, you know, take a cookie and leave a note in like a hotel lounge, right?
Often doesn't work so well.
No one leaves it. Let's switch over to the White House for a second. Big news this week, Annie, and you cover a lot of things, but Jared and Ivanka a lot of the time, as we call them, Javanka. This week, the White House announced that it was going to recognize Jerusalem as the capital of Israel and announced its intent to move its embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. At the same time, the entire Arab world is saying they're not into this, and the Palestinians are saying they're going to walk away from the peace talks that Jared is leading. Tell us what Jared is up to.
Well, that's funny, I guess.
Maybe not to Jared.
So Jared Kushner's role in the White House has become smaller and smaller as the year has gone on. We watched his, with the arrival of John Kelly, kind of got rid of his free-floating role where he could be in any meeting and was had kind of just in charge of this first among equal status in the White House. That no longer exists. He's under intense scrutiny from Robert Mueller's investigation. So this Middle East peace deal is like his last real thing.
His last hope he has.
Like, I've talked to people close to him who says, like, he is like, this is what he really wants to prove the skeptics wrong and prove himself. He knows people think that this 36-year-old real estate guy with no diplomatic experience is a unlikely candidate to solve the most intractable problem in the
world,
in the world history. But he's determined that this is going to be how he makes his name. He gave a speech on Sunday at the Saban Forum, which is the first time he's spoken publicly about
anything.
What he's doing.
About anything.
Yeah, we heard his voice. So when I first heard that Trump was going to make the announcement to declare Jerusalem the capital of Israel, which is a campaign promise, something he was lobbied hard on by Sheldon Adelson, my reaction was like, oh, well, my story is going to be like Kelly, Mueller, and now Trump are all just like making Jared's life impossible. Like, this is just now the president's stepping on any chance of peace. So yesterday I was reporting out of what does it mean for Jared's story, and actually I was surprised to find out that Jared was a huge backer of making this move. He has been, someone said, like, enthusiastic is an understatement. Like, this was him. And he thinks that he can have it both ways. Like, his reasoning is, this is historically important, and it will be one of the things the Trump administration has achieved that will last on for decades. And he thinks that after, this was actually a background quote that got a lot of attention yesterday, that, like, after some riots, things will go back to normal, and, like, the Palestinians and the Arabs will have to, publicly they have to say, we're against this, we're horrified, but quietly, they know that they need the U.S. to have any chance of peace, so they're hoping that, like, a chilling period and then cooling off period, and then everything will go back to normal.
But as we do in playbooks sometimes, we say but.
Yeah.
I don't really get the sense that Arab nations are saying, yeah, like, we're going to riot
it's
and then
cool,
we'll be okay.
No worries.
Do you get that sense?
Not yet. But we'll see. I mean, this is what they think that they can have, that they can have both ways. Some of the Jared Kushner's political advice is not always the best. Like, he famously
give us some examples of
that. That is amazing.
He famously agreed with Trump's decision to fire Comey, who was probably like the biggest one. So he's really taking a huge gamble here. Like, if this works, Jared Kushner will have had a historic role in the Middle East. If it doesn't,
he's still a billionaire.
This will go down along the lines of his judgment about Comey. Like, bad idea if their goal is a peace deal. So we'll see.
We'll be right back with more of our Playbook audio briefing, but first, a word from our sponsor, Pharma.
There is no tiptoeing into the unknown. Now is the time to put the accelerator to the floor. The best is yet to come, like advancements in personalized medicine and immunotherapy, and it's coming faster than we can imagine. Welcome to the future of medicine, where disease is no match for tenacity, no match for ingenuity, where together we go boldly. Learn more at goboldly.com.
Let's zoom out. So we often talk about Trump's Washington and how it's different than previous administrations. Maybe kind of like rapid fire, what has been one of the most surprising things to each of you about kind of covering Trump's Washington?
How much he's changed the Republican Party. Remember Paul Ryan's plan for Medicare in terms of the budget? We don't hear any talk about that anymore, and that's because Trump doesn't want to talk about it.
Right.
Conservatives bragging that we're going to keep the top tax rate where it is instead of giving everybody a tax cut across the board. That's just something you would never hear even 2 years ago. And then right now we're talking about a budget caps deal. We don't hear anything about offsets. I mean,
they're just spending money. They don't. What's shocking to us, and I'm sure all of us, having covered this for a long time, is from 2010 to 2016, we covered nothing but deficits, and we need to get the deficit under control. And now, Sungmin, there's one senator who says that.
Bob Corker, who just could not get there on the tax reform bill and was the only one to vote no. And I had talked to a lot of Senate Republicans about that deficit issue who had been under the previous administration talking about their concerns. And even after we saw these, you know, neutral reports saying even with economic growth, we're still going to lose about $1 trillion over a decade. And a lot of Republicans were like, hey, we don't really believe those anymore.
Yeah, don't believe the reports, right?
Exactly.
What Anna and I are writing a book about Trump's Washington or Congress and Trump's Washington, and we keep hearing these great anecdotes about Trump behind the scenes or the administration behind the scenes interacting with Congress. You guys must have a favorite anecdote about the Trump administration working with Congress that's really good that you love. What is it?
Dun, 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 dun. No pressure.
Let's talk about the DACA deal that
DACA
he struck
deal, which is
with. Okay, I guess it was not a DACA deal.
It was a deal that wasn't a deal.
The agreement that lasted all of, what, like 3 or 4 hours with the Democrats to do it.
Rachel, tell everybody what. Let's explain DACA for the one person in the room that doesn't know.
Democrats went to the White House, when was this, September? Late September, met with the president and said, we want to do a deal to ensure that Dreamers can stay in the country past March when their legal status basically expires. And he said, sure, great, want to do this. Don't worry about the wall. We'll do that another time. And Republicans, at least in the House, had been talking about how we got to have a wall in order to get some sort of deal on Dreamers. Now, Pelosi and Schumer came back and put out this statement, and then from what I hear, certain people in leadership who are close with the president called him and said, you can't do this. The base is going to go nuts. And so the president walked that back, and it was all because members of Congress had called him and were like, you cannot do this to Republicans. And so I think this just sort of shows how Trump, you know, when he negotiates, he just sort of flies by the seat of his pants. And then Republicans end up sort of like cleaning up after him, Republicans on the Hill. And they're struggling with that still. I mean, he jerked them left and then right on health care. First, they were going to repeal Obamacare first and then come up with a replacement. And then Trump said, no, I actually want to do both at the same time. And so they decided to do both at the same time. And that obviously didn't work out well. And then he said, yeah, he went back to the original plan, which is, why don't we just repeal it and replace it in a year or two? So it's just like there's no Republican plan in terms of big policy and how they're going to move forward. It just seems to be like, you know, Trump does one thing, Republicans try to clean up for him, and they try to get him on the same page as them, and it just never works out. So,
Annie, you covered the Clinton campaign. This has to be a very different experience covering the Trump White House.
It is. And just to answer your question about what's the biggest shock about Trump's Washington, I would say, just in covering the White House, that the best way to get engagement from the players that we care about is to write the palace intrigue stories. It is what
the stories they say they hate.
The stories they say they hate.
Who's up and who's down?
Are the only ways anyone returned your calls for the first 6 months of this administration. Mm-hmm. And they all, I think it was because of the factions, but they all really cared about protecting their own images. So I found that engaging on those stories, writing those stories, was the best way to source.
So, Annie, hold on. Now that you've brought that up, who is up and who is down in Trump's White House right now?
Right now. That's a good question.
Well, right now, meaning like at this hour.
Who is up and who's down? Pompeo seems to be on the rise.
Mike Pompeo, the CIA director, who we all know is going to be the next Secretary of State.
Yes. General Kelly, I don't know. I mean, what do you guys think? He's sort of...
It seems to me that Gary Cohn is probably not going to be around much longer after tax reform, is what people have told us.
You know, I had a dinner. I was at a dinner last night that Anna was at, too, and with some Republican women who are close with Gary Cohn, who actually said they think he'll be around for longer, because where would he go?
Well, he could...
and
he could enjoy being really rich.
And the other thing is that I think it's a lot harder than people think to walk away from the security clearance and the
Air Force One
and all of the stuff that comes around being a senior White House official. Like, we saw a lot, Gary Cohn for one, a lot of people expressed a lot of outrage after Trump's Charlottesville comments, and no one walked away. No one resigned. So I think that it's harder to walk away than we think. But February 1 is... Well, people expect Tillerson to go, potentially Gary Cohn to go. People are looking at the guys who need to stay a year to protect their assets as the likely candidates who might go once that year is up.
And there's also obviously a lot of speculation about Jared and Ivanka. How long do they last, right? If maybe he's going to solve Middle East peace in the next couple months and they'll be gone.
There's been constant speculation about them since the beginning.
Yeah. So we're almost out of time with this first panel, but I want to ask Sungmin and Rachel about, there doesn't seem like there's much of an idea about what comes next in the legislative calendar after today. Obviously, there's
after
been so
they
much
shut the government down in a few weeks.
Well, after there's been so much.
Jay, come on. I don't want to be here on Christmas.
So, Sungmin, why don't you start? What are you hearing that could be on the agenda?
Well, we always hear about infrastructure, which I'm a little bit skeptical about, because I think we've been supposed to be getting a infrastructure package from the White House every 2 weeks for the last several months. So I'm not sure.
But there is a report out today that it's going to come out in early January. So
we'll see what happens.
We're not going to hold our breath, right?
But I would. I am really interested in seeing how immigration plays out, because I am not sure that Democrats will win in their demands to try to attach some sort of permanent protections for Dreamers in these must-pass spending bills. And the dynamics have been a little bit different in the House versus the Senate, where in the House, a lot more Senate Republicans, because of their political futures, have been more willing to push their leadership on doing it this year. They have a lot of Latinos in their districts. They have a lot of constituents who'd be affected by the end of the status of these programs, whereas Senate Republicans have been much more adamant in saying, we're going to do this next year. We may not have to wait till March, which is the official deadline, but we'll do it in January. So that's, I don't see the movement yet. So maybe on the legislative front, if it's not attached to must-pass legislation, you could see them trying to work through immigration in the early part of next year. But again, we've covered the failures of immigration over and over again, yes. And there's no guarantee that this would succeed under the Trump administration.
And that is going to cause so much drama in the House when they finally reach a deal. And you know, do Republicans get on board with an agreement on immigration?
Exactly.
In the House, at least, it's going to be very toxic, I think, for Speaker Paul Ryan. I think, and it's been talked about a little bit, welfare reform. So my House sources, Republican sources, have said that the RC, the Republican Study Committee, which is this group of like 160 conservatives in the House, and the Freedom Caucus are both big fans of welfare reform. And I have spoken with someone close to Paul Ryan who said he is interested in this. And so we could see the House try to take on welfare next year through reconciliation or something like that. Now, the issue is going to be, this is an election year, and there's going to be a lot of swing state Republicans who could potentially, you know, their political lifeline is on, they're on the line. They could very well lose their seat to a Democrat. It's going to be a tough election for House Republicans. They could, you know, the House could flip and go to Nancy Pelosi. So I don't know that those moderate Republicans are going to want to do something like welfare reform next year, because I think that they're not going to want to go home and say, yeah, we're taking on programs that help people who are poor and who are disabled that cannot play well back home.
That is a good point for us to wrap. So Sungmin, Rachel, Annie, thank you guys so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you.